Welcome to a Flatpak History of Sweden.
Hi, welcome. I'm Elsa.
And I'm Chris. And this is episode 4, The Neolithic Swedes.
Very exciting.
Yes. So I think we're going to be adding on to what we started talking about last week with a little bit more in depth about all the different people who were living in Sweden and bits and pieces like that.
Yeah, this is a little bit of like the a little bit of decoration on the structure that we established in the previous episode.
Yeah, and so I guess you could say this is not necessarily a special episode, but a first sort of in-depth,
yeah,
rather than a bit of a broad brush episode. So that's going to be fun.
But should we kick it off with the Swedish phrase of the week first?
Yeah, there was something that came up earlier this week when we were doing research or something, and I mentioned it to you, and I wasn't sure what it was.
It's less of an expression, more of just a word, and the word is handfallen.
Okay, so like handfall.
Yeah, literally that's what it translates to, hand fallen or with fallen hands.
And how would you use that?
Well, it means sort of stunned or confused. I looked up the definition and it said handfallen, surprised and confused to such an extent that you are unsure how to react.
Okay, so if someone unexpectedly resigned from the government.
Yeah.
You would say I was or am handfallen, both the same?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was handfallen that blah, blah, blah resigned from the government.
Yeah, or you face a problem that you're so shocked by the problem and confused that you don't know how to deal with it. So
okay, so in like the storms that we've been having in the UK recently,
yeah,
Kiara and Dennis,
yeah,
nice recent storms. So if something happened and you couldn't get into your house or something like that, you would be handfallen.
Exactly.
At how to, yeah.
You stand there with fallen hands, not knowing what to do. Like many Swedish words, quite literal in how they're structured, is what it says.
Cool. It does what it says on the tin.
Exactly.
What you would say. Cool.
But we are not handfallen now. We are ready to start the episode.
We are most definitely not handfallen now. So last week we talked about the Neolithic period and how early farming and the concepts of ownership were introduced through a massive long period of time. And we're going to be covering the same time period again, sort of backtracking a little bit, but as we go, looking at a bit more in detail at the various cultures at the time, because there wasn't just one overarching Swedish or Northern European culture.
Yeah, so because whilst we mentioned that some parts of Sweden started farming, other areas didn't. It's actually because they are seen as being different cultures that started and ended at different sections in the Neolithic period. And that's because whilst the Neolithic period in Sweden is everything from 4200 BCE to 1800 BCE, so that's up until when the Bronze Age starts, pretty much, there are more distinctions that can be relatively easily made. Another handy thing about this period, and in fact from now on in the podcast, is that it was around 4500 BCE that Sweden took its present shape geographically, more or less at this point. So you can from now start looking at modern day maps for at least the shape of the geography. Because, of course, the political boundaries of countries and regions, that will continue to change pretty much up until the present day.
Yeah, that's something that we now have ticked off, create a mass of land that is Sweden. But let's start with the Neolithic period, shall we? Most historians and timelines do split it into the early, middle and late Neolithic, but today we're just going to be talking about it in one big block.
Why is that?
Yeah, so the Swedish Neolithic period on its own is easier to split up by the three different types of culture that were present at the time and when they came to prominence. So In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about these three cultures, compare them to find out their similarities and differences, and to find out what was so special about them.
That's exciting. Where to begin?
Yes, exactly. Where to begin? So last week, we alluded to the fact that there were different types of living patterns and styles in Sweden during this period. Some people liked to farm and some people liked to stick to hunting, gathering and fishing, all the things that had served them so well up till that point. But just that they did it with a bit more technology and variety in the animal life. I think, remember the really early Paleolithic and Mesolithic people?
Yeah, no, I certainly remember their the increase in variety of food.
Yeah.
I'm always very interested in what people eat.
Yeah, so they got a lot more of things like that, but didn't necessarily change the actual day-to-day living. But there is a lot of debate about where and how the cultures that we're going to be talking about soon developed, or if they came up with their own inventions themselves. They also appeared at different points because, again, this period is so long and varied, it's hard to create a flowing narrative per se. So I think start off with just introducing them all.
Yeah, shall we introduce them? Go ahead, please.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, yes, the stage is yours. So introduce the cultures.
Yeah. So we have the funnel cup culture, the pitted ware culture, and the boat or battle axe culture.
Don't worry, they have equally weird names in Swedish, probably in all languages. So English isn't getting the short end of the straw here. They are quite. There's a reason why they're named what they are. But I think for simplicity's sake, we are going to call the third one the battle axe culture, rather than calling it the boat axe culture. It's just it's funnier to call it battle axe culture.
Yeah, and a boat axe. You know, so just a bit of a weird phrase in general, I think.
Yeah, but the first culture, the funnel cups, they're sometimes also called the beakers. They dominated south and central Sweden. And these were guys who were also in Denmark and eastern Norway. These were the guys who we mainly started talking about at the start of the episode last week, because they started the whole farming thing.
Hooray! Thank you, farming revolution. The pitted ware culture came a little bit after the funnel beakers and was most common in parts of the south and the western and eastern coastal areas, along with being around the Lake Mälaren region, which is just inland from Stockholm, basically, over on the east side of the country. They seem to have shunned the farming developments of the funnel beakers, preferring the coastal living, surviving off fishing, and the hunter-gatherer tactics of yesteryear.
Oh, that's interesting. So we also touched on the third and last culture last week when we spoke of developments in the Neolithic period. The battle axe culture, they're the people responsible for a lot of those changes. There is evidence that they apparently appeared in Northern Europe in the middle of the third millennium BCE. So that's 2500 BCE-ish. They were apparently strikingly different to the older groups. They invaded or simply came to live from the Ural Mountains or the Ukraine. So you guessed it, you've heard about them before. They're the Yamnayas.
Yay, Yamnayas. I hope everybody remembers them from last week and all their genetic evidence of moving around. But so now we've just briefly touched on them. I think we should start talking in more detail about them in order.
Yeah. So should we start with the funnel beakers? These guys started everything off, kicking off the Neolithic age around 4300 BCE. The funnel beaker culture is named for its characteristic ceramics, beakers and amphorae, with funnel-shaped tops, a lot of which were found in graves. We'll talk more about graves later on in the episode. The funnel beaker culture was a culture in North Central Europe. It developed as a merger of local Neolithic cultures around modern-day Poland, parts of Germany and Denmark, and that ever-present south of Sweden. We'll mainly be talking about what can be found in Sweden, but as always, there is no Sweden just yet, so we need to look at what the culture is doing in the general area.
Yes, the funnel beakers introduced farming and husbandry as a major source of food, different to the pottery-using hunter-gatherers who stayed doing their thing north of the funnel beaker area in northern Scandinavia, basically anything more than halfway up from Sweden. Anything more than halfway up Sweden, basically. With the exception of some outlying inland locations, the settlements are located near those of the previous cultures who lived mainly on the coast. It was characterized by single family houses, roughly the size of a modern day garage, I guess, shall we say. And the culture was dominated by animal husbandry of sheep, cattle, pigs and goats, but there was also hunting and fishing to add to the land animals that they domesticated. Might as well keep that expertise alive.
Yeah, one amazing find assigned to the funnel beaker culture is the Bronochice, if anyone knows the correct pronunciation, do let us know. The pot from Poland, which shows the oldest known depiction of a wagon, presumably drawn by aurochs, whose remains were found with the pot. It was dated by a radiocarbon method to between 3,500 and 3,350 BCE.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. And I'm going to go on a little bit of an auroch tangent, as aurochs are something I really wish was still around today.
Yeah.
So they were sort of a European species of wild ox, but the last ones died out in a Polish forest in the middle of the 1620s or so, which is a massive shame. I've actually spent quite a bit of time reading The History of the European Aurochs, which is a PhD thesis by Elizabeth Wright at the University of Sheffield a few years ago. It was actually quite fun. It's generally agreed to be the ancestor of domestic cattle. That's the auroch, and certainly bigger than our cattle today. The aurochs reached their northernmost limit in Sweden, which was in the early Mesolithic period. And there have been fossil specimens in the counties of Östergötland, Västergötland, and a Mesolithic site at Hörnborgasjön, a lake in Västergötland. So we're talking south central Sweden, basically. And this is a bit of a long quote, but it's quite fun too. It's likely that a combination of reasons contributed to the extinction of the aurochs, but the general scarcity of auroch finds across much of Europe during the Neolithic period do not suggest that they were being hunted in very large numbers prior to extinction. For this reason, the destruction of habitat may have been a more prominent factor. In addition, in some areas such as Scandinavia, extinction may have also been aided by rising sea levels, which fragmented the populations. By the Bronze Age, the aurochs were rare in some areas, and it disappeared from southern Scandinavia at around 500 BCE. So these amazing creatures were common throughout the Mesolithic and Neolithic period in Sweden. Their depiction on the pot from Poland is, as we said, one of the earliest depictions of farming, and the oldest, as far as we know, depiction of a wagon. So that's showing you that the funnel beakers were already smashing the farming game, having their wagons with their huge oxen pulling them around. That's really making your life much easier if you're doing that.
Yeah, and also what I love about the aurochs is that they sound like they're something out of Harry Potter, but actually they were a real thing.
Yeah, I don't know who named them.
Good name, solid name. But shall we go back to the funnel beaker culture?
Yeah.
As we've seen, the funnel beakers had mastered how to grow primitive wheat and barley. They grew these on small patches that were fast depleted because they were using this slashing and burning process that we talked about last week. And as a result, the population frequently moved short distances, rotating the fields and building new huts or moving their older ones. This is peak Neolithic farming. But there was also mining, amazingly, in the Malmö region, which is in the south of Sweden, and nearby a collection of flintstone from the Polish mountains have been found, which was traded into regions lacking the stone, such as the Scandinavian hinterland. whilst these people weren't one people, they were clearly trading and moving about together, sharing these goods they were working so hard to produce.
And there's also evidence of some sort of religious or ritual behaviour in the communities. The flint axes and the vessels were also deposited in streams and lakes near the farmlands. And virtually all of Sweden's 10,000 plus flint axes that have been found from this culture were probably sacrificed in water. What that was for, we can only really speculate. I don't know if any ideas.
No.
Just something culty, religious-y.
Tweet us if you have any ideas of why they sacrificed their axes in water. One of the crazier things about these guys, what they got up to, was constructing large cult centres surrounded by fences, earthworks and moats. The largest one of this is found at Sarup on Fyn, just over the water in modern-day Denmark. This site was over 85,000 square metres, and it's estimated to have taken 8,000 workdays to build it. Now, that's a lot of effort in a culture that still has to work very hard just to produce all of its food, despite the orcs to help them. Another cult centre is at Stävje near Lund, back in Skåne. That is about 30,000 square metres in size, and showing that these Swedes of the time, they certainly got up to the same thing.
Yeah, so that's really impressive sort of man hours work putting into all this stuff. So it's clearly important to them. But as time moves on, we're moving on to the pitted ware culture now. I'd like to call them the pits for simplicity, but I think that might be a bit rude. So I think we'll just stick with pitted ware. But they seem to be around for most of the Neolithic, straddling the end of the funnel beakers and the beginning of the battle axes. The culture arose around 3500 BCE, and its earliest sites are found in east-central Sweden, where it appears to have replaced the funnel beaker culture. It expanded, and its expansion is accompanied by the disappearance of settlements of the funnel beaker culture throughout large parts of southern Scandinavia. This was because they didn't really subscribe to the whole farming thing and therefore static way of life. So they were more mobile and able to move into other areas of the country.
Yeah, just like in the Mesolithic time, settlements didn't really need to be a thing for the pitted wares. But we still have evidence that they came to occupy the coasts of Denmark, southern Sweden, southern Norway and various islands on in the Baltic Sea, such as Öland, Gotland and Åland. So the pitted ware culture was a hunter-gatherer culture. Despite its Mesolithic style economy, it is by convention classed as Neolithic, since it falls within the period in which farming reached Scandinavia. The pitted ware people were largely maritime hunters, like their forebearers, and were engaged in lively trade with both the agricultural communities of the Scandinavian interior and other hunter-gatherers in the region. There were lively contacts with communities in Finland and the eastern Baltic. During its formative years, the pitted ware culture also coexisted with the funnel beakers back in Sweden.
That's probably the most interesting part of this period, is the coexistence between the two groups at this point. Although the two cultures exchanged goods with each other, its peoples appear to have had widely different identities, and they didn't seem to mix that much with to any notable extent. Throughout its existence of more than 1,000 years, the pitted ware culture remained virtually unchanged.
Hmm. The culture is not for turning.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a Margaret Thatcher reference for those unfamiliar with British history. Also, from around 2800 BCE, the pitted ware culture coexisted for some time with the battle axe culture. So now we're at the end of the period, which succeeded the remnants of the funnel beaker culture in southern Scandinavia. But half a millennium later, again, we are talking about huge time periods here, in around 2300 BCE, The pitted ware culture had been absorbed by the battle axe culture, and they were no more. The following Nordic Bronze Age represents a fusion of elements from the pitted ware culture and the battle axe culture. And modern Scandinavians, apart from Sami, still display partial genetic origins from the pitted ware people.
Yeah, so yeah, you can see that still today, so that's quite interesting. But what about the pitted ware way of life? Their temporary dwellings were typically located along the coast, as we mentioned. They usually lived in smaller huts, definitely smaller than the houses type size of the funnel beakers. And their economy was based on fishing, hunting, gathering of wild plants. The sites that we've found contain bones from elk, deer, beaver, seal, porpoise, pigs. And pig bones especially seem to be found in large quantities on some pitted ware sites. And they come from wild boar rather than from the domestic pigs that the funnel beakers would have kept and eaten themselves. And the hunting of seals was particularly important. And for this reason, I read somewhere that the pitted ware people have been called the hardcore sealers or the Inuit of the Baltic.
That's a name if I ever heard one. Hardcore sealers.
Yeah, that's quite random, but not random at all, but it's fun, certainly. Yeah.
Again, seasonal migration was a feature of life for these people, as with many other hunter-gatherer communities of the Mesolithic age before them. Pitted ware communities in eastern Sweden probably spent most of the year at their main village on the coast, making seasonal forays inland to hunt for boars and fur-bearing animals and to engage in exchange with farming communities in the interior. As we mentioned, some of the pitted ware peoples appear to have been specialized hunters who engaged in the trade of animal goods with people throughout the Baltic region. They used their skill in hunting to gather materials and goods that other people would have struggled to get themselves.
Yeah, well, that's always one way to run an economy, is produce or give people things that they don't already have. And one notable feature of the pitted ware culture is the sheer quantity of shards of pottery on its sites, and quite clearly leading to its name. The culture's named after the typical ornamentation of its pottery. They sort of had horizontal rows of pits pressed into the pot before it was fired and all properly finished. So that's where the name comes from. But yeah, so maybe we really should call them the pit people, but I think that could be confusing with holes in the ground. So yeah, I'll give up on that one. Yeah. But
pitted ware.
Yes. Although some of the vessels are flat-bottomed, others are round base or pointed, so it'd be easy to stably put them into the ground or in the fire. And in shape and decoration, this type of ceramic apparently reflects influences from Finland and other parts of Northeast Europe. That's more example of knowledge sharing, really.
Yeah, and even more cool, I think, are the small animal figurines modelled out of clay and bone that have been found. A large number of these clay figurines have been found at Jetböle at Jumala on the island of Åland, including some which combine seal and human features. I'd love to see some more of those. The tools used by the pitted ware people seem to have varied across the country. However, the use of fish hooks, harpoons, and nets and sinkers, that's fairly widespread. Tanged arrowheads made from blades of flintstones are abundant on Scandinavia's west coast and were probably used in the hunting of marine mammals. Like those poor seals.
Yep.
Otherwise, how would they know how to make their accurate designs?
Yeah, with all the fancy seal, clay seals. You can't draw them and make them properly unless you've got a few up close.
Yeah, if you've seen a few of them up close. Oh, poor seals.
Yes, but so they're done. Pitted wares are done. So let's move on to those with by far the best name, the battle axe culture. Oh. They emerged in the south of the Scandinavian peninsula around 2800 BCE. It's probably an offshoot of the corded ware culture, another European culture of the time, and which in itself was largely an offshoot of the Yamnayas from the Ukrainian steppes. And as we mentioned last week, modern genetic studies show that its emergence was accompanied by large-scale migrations and genetic displacement. The battle axe culture is thought to have been responsible for spreading the Indo-European languages and other elements of culture to the region, and it existed for quite a time with the hunter-gatherers of the pitted ware culture, which it eventually absorbed and turned into the Nordic Bronze Age.
Yeah. The concentration of the battle axe culture was in Skåne in the south of Sweden, but sites of the battle axe culture have been found throughout the coastal areas of southern Scandinavia and southwest Finland, so they definitely were not limiting themselves to just Skåne. The immediate coastline was, however, occupied by the previously mentioned pitted ware culture. So if you think of it a bit like a pizza, the centre is the battle axe and the crust is the pitted ware culture.
Tasty.
Tasty. I don't know if that analogy made sense. Either way, this distinction isn't too important, as it takes just about 500 years by 2300 BCE for the battle axe culture to have absorbed the pitted ware culture.
Yep, so they're all gone, and the battle axe are the last culture standing. But throughout its presence and its existence, the battle axe culture appears to have expanded into coastal Norway as well, and this is accompanied by dramatic cultural changes. There have been sites reported of the battle axe culture inside the Norwegian Arctic Circle in the Lofoten Islands, and also as far north as the present city of Tromsø, which is so far away from Skåne, it's scary.
Yeah. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Skåne anymore, is what they would have said when they got to Tromsø.
And took Toto with them. The battle axe culture is mostly known for its burials, where we get a lot of the information about them from. And there's been around 250 of them found in Sweden. But as promised, we're going to be talking about burials specifically a bit later on in the episode. And the flint axes that they've produced, along with the pitted ware culture, can trace a common origin in the southwest of Skåne and Denmark. A few of the settlements have been uncovered, though, and most of them are located inland, but some are still on the coastal areas where they would have occupied them after the pitted ware culture went away.
Sadly, less than 100 settlements are known, and their remains are few and far between, as they are located on continually used and rotated farmland and have consequently been ploughed away. Maybe by those pesky aurochs.
Yeah, hey, don't blame the aurochs.
No, blame the people who use the aurochs to plough fields. Archaeological remains of southern Sweden reveal close spatial relations between houses and graves. This suggests that a farm was the centre of social and economic activity in the battle axe culture. They weren't travelling to another location to bury their dead in a cultural setting. The battle axe culture was based on the same agricultural practices as the previous funnel beaker culture, but with less focus on wheat and more on animals. The battle axe culture appears to have emphasized cattle herding, which explains the apparent quasi-mobile nature of the culture and less settlements being found, as that takes less permanence than farming wheat and grains. So they're actually mixing both cultures here. They also appear to have engaged in trade with populations to their north, exchanging animal goods with material goods.
Yeah, and moving more on to those physical remains and looking at the trade, you can see that battle axe pottery have been found frequently in pitted ware settlements. So some settlements display fusions of the pottery styles of the battle axe culture and the pitted ware culture. The relationship between these two cultures is controversial, though, and not particularly well understood. But a Norwegian archaeologist, Aina Ostmø, emphasises that the North Atlantic and North Sea coastal regions of Scandinavia and the wider Baltic areas were united by a vigorous maritime economy. So they're all working together, permitting a wider spread and closer cultural unity than the interior continental cultures could get by themselves. And Einar also points to the widely found number of rock carvings assigned to this period of time, which display thousands of ships that they've been drawing on the rock carvings. And to sea cultures like the battle axe cultures and those around them, the sea was certainly more of a highway or a road than it was a divider.
Indeed. And there were also cultural differences between the battle axes and those who came before. The social system of the battle axe culture was markedly different than that of the funnel beaker culture. This is marked by the fact that the funnel beaker culture had collective, sort of megalithic style graves with a great deal of sacrifice to the graves. But the battle axe culture has individual graves with individual sacrifices. Individualism appears to have played a much more prominent part in their culture than among its predecessors. This really builds on from what we were talking about last week about ownership and the model of society once it becomes a farming, property-based economy. You do get a rise of a more individualistic style of thinking and seeing the world.
Yeah, so to summarise, we can see that the cultures were similar but different, with the battle axe perhaps combining the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. The funnel beakers came first and started the farming, utilising some of the new techniques available to them. The pitted wares then became a thing and started their retro return to hunter-gathering before the battle axes took over and took all the best bits from them and turning them into the victorious Neolithic period winners.
Yay! They got out on top in the end. But you would expect so with a name like that. I mean, if you're called Battle Axe, you can't lose. As we mentioned earlier, one of the biggest differences was how they liked to bury their dead. So I think we should pay special attention to that.
Yes, we did promise you some grave talk, so here we go. It was during the Neolithic period that some cultures that we've been talking about began building the oldest monumental or megalithic graves in Sweden. A megalith is a large stone that's been used to construct a structure or a monument, either alone by itself, just one big giant stone, or together with other ones in more of a formation. And megalithic graves are therefore graves that use these giant stone techniques.
Indeed. The oldest megalithic graves in Sweden were relatively simple dolmen graves. Now, dolmen graves, that's another word for those graves that looked a bit like a loaf of bread under the soil that we talked about last week. These were the domain of the funnel beakers. These tombs were built in quite a short space of time, around 3300 to 3000 BCE. This was right in the middle of the funnel beaker culture, and they loved these things. These graves were based on several large vertically placed stone to help them form a small chamber or opening where you would then put in the body. Sometimes the dolmen graves were actually left exposed, so you just saw the stone out in the open. A ceiling slab, perhaps, is the most impressive part of it.
Yeah, and if you just stick Swedish dolmen graves into a search engine, you can see a lot of pictures of them. They pop up all the time. And there's a really impressive article in the Journal of Archaeological Science by Carl-Johan Sjögren, where he goes into this in great detail and also looks at the role that they played and in society and how they actually were. You could find a lot of teeth of cows and pigs, and he's used them to trace their various isotopes and genetic details to find where they were raised and where they ended up being found in the archaeological record. And he's got a really handy map as well. Everybody likes a good map. And this shows you that the dolmen graves are really concentrated in the west coast, which is now Bohuslän, and around the general coast of the south of Sweden in Skåne. There's also a spot really far, quite far inland, called Falbygden. Interestingly, he says that based on over 300 separate tests of carbon dating, the building of megalithic tombs seems to have occurred simultaneously over a large area, including northern Germany, Denmark, Sweden, and even southern Norway. So it's spread around quite far.
Yeah, and actually the rest of the article is really interesting, as it talks a lot about how the Neolithic economy was run. Mr. Sjögren says that if you look at the evidence of isotopes, pollen and animal bone refuse, you can see that the middle Neolithic economy in Falbygden is almost identical to the one out on the coast. So the funnel beakers spreading across the countryside with the same method of living. They were living off domestic crops and animals for their food.
Yeah, and that main site that he's talking about, Falbygden, has a lot of evidence to show that it wasn't just locally based self-sustaining economy during the Middle Neolithic, but rather was integrated into a much larger economic and social system. The cattle in particular were coming from elsewhere in many cases, and he says in fact that the mobility of cattle is in fact much higher than that of humans, for which the frequency of non-local individuals is about 25%. And not only prestige items and humans were circulating, but also basic components of subsistence.
Yeah. I know Chris really could go on another cattle teeth tangent, yeah, but overall, I think we should leave it there. Go find the article if you want to read more. It is called A Complex Neolithic Economy: Isotope Evidence for the Circulation of Cattle and Sheep in the Funnel Beaker Culture of Western Sweden.
I love how, you know, once you're getting into this level of depth, the titles of the articles themselves need a little bit of working out.
Well, that's symptomatic for academic articles, I believe, quite long titles in general. But back to the graves themselves. The dolmen grave at Hoving in the parish of Hovlunda on the Swedish south coast is one of the most famous dolmen graves in the country. This is what's known as a long dolmen with a rectangular grave chamber and an edge chain. In total, there are about 100 dolmens that have been found in Sweden, of which 44 of them have been found in Skåne in the south and 44 in Bohuslän on the west.
Yeah, and if you add these to the more recent passage graves, which come from around 3000 BCE, these were larger and more complex, involving building an elongated chamber of vertical stones with ceiling slabs. The grave at Barsebäck, northwest of Lund in Skåne, is a particularly important example when you're looking at these types of things. And both passage graves and dolmens, of which, when you add them both together, there's about 550 of them. They were usually covered with earth to form mounds, but as we said, there are a few that they just left open or, have been exposed over the time. And the remains of the dead were usually deposited alongside with a few articles of everyday life, such as a weapon or domestic pot or that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Megalithic graves were also used more than once and probably also served as cult sites. Given the context of effort and resources and time to make them, they are believed to be the graves of an elite in society, becoming more stratified due to the ownership issue that we mentioned last week. They seem to be clustered around the southwest. They could potentially be the graves of powerful local farmers, family members, or even some sort of chieftains. Now, very importantly, the pitted ware people were typically buried in flat graves. Unlike the funnel beakers, they did not have megalithic graves. Pitted ware burials are also distinguished from funnel beaker burials through their use of red ochre. So you can see that the pitted wares were less interested in building huge, expensive stone graves. Could this be because they have less time on their hands, because they need to forage and hunt for survival? maybe, or just because they weren't stationary for as long, so there wasn't the point, as they'd be moving to another spot for food. Who knows? Probably a bit of both.
Yeah, I think like with most things, it's probably a bit of both. You can see how it is possible to use these graves to try and work out how the society functioned. Through graves, people have suggested that the social system of the battle axe was also different from the funnel beakers as well. In the battle axe culture, the dead were normally put into a single flat grave. They were dug, you know, there's lots of research done on to see how they were dug in particular angles, these ones being in north to south, with the men placed on their left while women placed on their right. And the grave goods also seem to be quite common as well. We have axes of flint that are found in both male and female burials, for example. And battle axes are placed with the men and are put close to their head. And these battle axes appear to have been status symbols, and it's from where the culture is named.
Ceramics were also quite common grave goods in battle axe cultures. Others include a wide array of arrowheads, weapons made out of antler. Now, that's cool. Antler weapons. Amber beads and polished flint axe and chisels. Other remains from burials include red deer, sheep and goat. What a party in those graves.
The place to be, clearly, yeah. is in the graveyard.
Antlers and goats. A new find came in 1993 when archaeologists excavated in a place called Töringe in Sörmland in south central Sweden. They found pots and axes, all very typical of the battle axe culture. But most interestingly, there were also the cremated remains of at least six people. And this is the earliest find of cremation in Scandinavia. That's another first for the Neolithic age.
Yeah, they're creating their checklist and they're checking it twice, ticking everything off. So yeah, that's quite
invent,
for some reason.
Invent cremation tick.
I mean, probably invent checklist first. Yeah. Step one, create your steps.
invent, what do you think was invented first, writing or the checklist? Because how do you put invent writing on a checklist?
Well, you can have a mental checklist.
Before you invent... All right, massive tangent.
Yeah, checklist tangent. So, yeah, have third tangent check. But, yes, right, so that's sort of the burials and graves done. I think it's now time for a short feature that we're going to be introducing every now and then as we progress through the timeline when we get a few minutes. We're going to talk now for a little bit about what's going on in the rest of the world with some famous or perhaps overlooked examples to show you what non-Swedes were getting to.
Yeah.
Getting up to even.
Yeah, we could maybe call this feature the neighbours or the rest of the world section. I don't know. You tell us what you think it should be called. We haven't got a name yet. The idea is to give you an idea of where we are in history and help you place these events in your mind. So, what was going on in the rest of the world? The passage graves and dolmens that we've talked about were actually found more in Denmark than anywhere else in Western Europe. The Danes loved them. They loved them so much, they spread them around to the coastal Swedish areas. This is where we think they came from, most immediately, in Denmark. And in Denmark, a single passage grave can contain up to 100 skeletons, which is quite grim.
Yeah, pretty grim. But great for archaeologists. You don't have to. You just find one site and then check, you're done. But now, one of my favourites, smack bang in the middle of this period, we have the Gigantea temples on Malta and Gozo, which is, the boot of Italy, kicking the football of Sicily. That's Malta is a very tiny country on its own. over three small islands just the south of Sicily. And in short, Malta had a temple phase. Don't we all go through a temple phase at some point?
We all remember the temple phase.
Yeah, my temple phase was particularly tragic. But Malta's temple phase occurred during the same time as Sweden's Neolithic period. And the temple phase itself, like a lot of these phases, is split into its own phases, one being the Gigantia phase, which is Maltese for gigantic, perhaps not so surprisingly once you look at the temples. And it's named after the Gigantia site in Gozo, where one such example of these crazy temples exist. Perhaps the more famous internationally, if they are famous at all internationally, is the Hagiaim temple complex on Malta itself. The Gigantia temples are the earliest type of megalithic temples in Malta, and they're older than the pyramids in Egypt. So they're pretty old. Wow. And their makers created the two Hagiaim Gigantia temples during the Neolithic period, between 3600 to 2500 BCE, huge time range, but it makes these temples more than 5,500 years old if you use the longer time reference, and the world's second oldest religious structures, after a site in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, or however you would say that. And when I was living in Malta, the Maltese absolutely loved telling me that the Gigantia temples at Hagiaim are potentially at least 1,000 years older than Stonehenge. So, yeah.
Yeah, these temples are huge, and you could do an entire podcast on just them. There's so much to talk about with them, along the same kind of questions as we have with Stonehenge. Why did they build them? Why does it align with the sun? Were only the elite allowed to go there? But do Google them. It's spelled H-A-G-A-R space Q-I-M. So Google them and find out some more. Closer to home for us, Stonehenge was also built in a similar, around this period in the UK. In case you don't know, Stonehenge is a ring of standing stones around, each is around 4 meters high and 2 meters wide. They weigh around 25 tons each, so quite big. The stones are set inside a load of earthworks in the middle of a huge complex of Neolithic and Bronze Age monuments in southern England.
Yeah, and I remember learning loads of about Stonehenge. We even went there on a trip when I did my A-level in archaeology. That's high school for Americans and other countries out there with that sort of education system. And yeah, there are, again, so many questions about Stonehenge. I think as soon as you find one fact, that then leads you to 15 more questions. But archaeologists believe it was constructed around 3000 BC to 2000 BC, in that sort of period. And the banks and the ditches are going to be the earliest part of that production. And radiocarbon dating says that the first of the blue stones, the huge mega stones that were put in, they were there between about 2400 and 2200 BCE. Although they might have been put there much earlier. It's really hard to tell with a lot of these things.
Heading to perhaps the most famous of the period, the earliest known Egyptian pyramids are found at Saqqara, which is near Memphis. The earliest one is the pyramid of Djoserand.
Yeah, that's good enough.
If you know how it's pronounced, please let us know.
This could be a continuing feature of the rest of the world part of.
Well, I know how to pronounce a lot of the Swedish place names that we mentioned. If you know how to pronounce place names elsewhere, please let's exchange a bit of knowledge with each other. Send me a voice message with how places are pronounced. Back to the pyramids. The pyramid is thought to be the world's oldest monumental structure made out of dressed masonry.
So, okay, and that's quite old because it's from, like, I don't know, mid 2600s-ish, yeah, or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I've read. When using these examples to look back at what is happening in Sweden, there is nothing at all on this sort of scale in Sweden, nowhere near. When you're looking at stone circles in Sweden, which are even slightly comparable to Stonehenge. Some of the most famous ones are from 500 BC to 500 AD, so much, much later. And there are no huge temple complexes or pyramids either. And the megalithic graves are more lithic and less mega, to be honest.
Yeah, but they're still mega interesting. So the mega interesting Neolithic megalithic graves of Sweden, I think we should call them.
That's good.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that this wasn't an achievement, building these larger complexes that we talked about in Denmark and near Lund. Think of all the rubbish weather they had to put up with.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's ever so slightly warmer and nicer in Malta and Egypt, that's for sure. But, yeah, I think that's probably us done for this week. Mm-hmm. We've spent a lot of time looking at the three main Neolithic cultures, the funnel beakers, the pitted ware culture, and the battle axe culture.
Yeah, and we looked at all manner of crazy artifacts and graves that came along with them to try and help understand why they were different from each other. Next week, we'll see how the battle axe culture kickstarted the change into the Bronze Age and how Sweden gets to grips with its first metals.
Exciting. I like metals. But as always, please do give us a review on wherever you can find us, particularly iTunes and places like that. We're also on Pocket Casts, which I've now learned is a thing, Spotify, Stitcher, loads of places. I think there is a problem with Google Podcasts because you can't upload from the UK for some bizarre reason. We'll try and investigate that. But I think we said last week that we were on there. We were going to be, and then I got an annoying message saying, "Oh, you're not a UK, you're not a US or Canadian resident." So.
Oh no, we're on the wrong side of the pond.
Yeah, we'll have to. We'll do a little bit more investigating, yeah. But we'll try and be on those things.
In the meantime, you can find us, like Chris is saying, on many other platforms. We are also on Twitter at Flatpak Sweden. But for now, it's goodbye from us.
Goodbye. Hey door.
Hey door.